The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening. We spoke last time about some basics of parenting. Wanted to maybe look at this from a bit of a different perspective. There's some general principles of successful parenting, an outline that's based on Rabbi Shlomo Volbe's, Zochreinu Livrocha's book that was translated, and I guess it's called Planting and Building. It has some very, like a review of some very basic principles, the kind of stuff that if not for the fact that your children see it, you would want to hang on the refrigerator to remember all the time. He has, I believe, 7 points, which I'd like to elaborate on a little bit this evening. Most of them are not really very new, but it's a concise overview of some of the things that we have to be aware of. And I believe that we've mentioned this before, but it's something that's important to remember, that the type of work that parenting requires and the type of preparation that it requires is not just intellectual, it's emotional. It means taking the information that maybe we all know and we have here and traversing what the Bali Musa say is the longest distance of the world and bringing it to our hearts so that it'll be there on instant emotional recall. That when an incident happens, when a conflict takes place, when there's a problem that arises, that we're able to respond from the emotional vantage point using all of the intellectual understanding that we have rather than just the emotional response and having forgotten temporarily the intellectual, the knowledge that we have. And therefore, it's important to review and have concise outlines and to work on it much as we would work on anything that we want to sensitize and prepare ourselves for constant, instant recall and appropriate emotional responses in difficult situations. I'm fond of quoting one of my children who I guess must have been listening to some of my speeches, and when he wouldn't like, as a teenager, the way I'm dealing with certain of the issues with him, he would say, wait a minute, let's assume somebody would call now from the outside and ask advice how to deal with this kind of situation. You know, what would you say? Well, why can't you respond that way to your own children? Now, we ask that question many times. We can give good advice about parenting to others. When it comes to our own, it's a lot harder. The emotions are raging. Everything is personal. It's the love is overwhelming. The responsibility, the identity with the child, and therefore it becomes much harder to be objective and to always perform and act in a way that we intellectually would know is appropriate. Therefore, this type of review is very, very important. The first principle that he mentions is create a powerfully warm bond of love and trust. Build intimacy and have open communication. That's quite a mouthful. A warm bond. There has to be a bond. The bond is a connection. We're connected. We're involved. We're together. We feel this closeness. If we're not in touch for a day or two, there's something amiss. We feel part of us is lacking, like a piece of me is missing. How could I not know and be updated and know what's going on in your life? It's a bond, and it's a warm bond. It's a vibrant bond. It's alive. And it's a bond that's built not only on love, but on trust. And trust is a very, very important thing. The earliest emotion that a child develops with a parent is this sense of trust. They learn to count on us for everything that they need. In the earliest stages of life, they have to trust us for everything because there's nothing that they can do. And that develops. And if that deep-rooted emotion is is crossed, is disappointed, and they find that they've put their trust in us and we fail. We haven't delivered according to that trust. It can be the most devastating blow to that warm bond that has to exist between parent and child. So as important, and maybe even more important, is that sense of trust. That sense of trust requires honesty. That sense of trust requires openness. That sense of trust requires forthright talking. And if we're less than candid, or if they feel that we don't speak honestly to them, or if we don't exhibit a trust in them, sometimes what brings out trust the best is that if you can trust me, then I can trust you. And if these things are lacking, then we break the most critical ingredient in that bond, which can tie us together with our children and our children to us, and therefore guide them in the right direction, motivate them to move to the right direction, and prevent them from falling off and going into all different directions. And again, build intimacy. It's intimate. It's personal. It's not just a superficial relationship. Many parents, many kids say that their parents think they have a close, warm relationship with them. But in reality, it's very, you know, like, how was your day? Not even pay attention to the answer. You know, at the end of the conversation, love you, goodbye. But no real interest, no real follow-up, no real involvement, no real attention to the intricate and intimate details and emotions. The empathy for the nuances of teenage emotions. Now, teenage emotions can be like a roller coaster. And if you really empathize with those emotions, you can get dizzy. But even though it might be a dizzying experience, it's critical to create that sense of an intimate bond between parent and child. And of course, open communication. Open communication is very, very important. And if our children can't communicate with us and we can't communicate with them, then the bond and the relationship is to naught. It doesn't give anything over. It doesn't really accomplish. We don't know where to go with it. And communication requires the willingness for them to communicate with us, requires a certain openness, requires a certain balance, requires that we can't get bent out of shape if they tell us something that's less than exactly what we would like to hear or be proud to hear. And although we can't condone inappropriate behavior, but we must be very careful not to condemn when we hear something. If our reactions are angry or violent or condemning or disparaging in any way, then they will not communicate. And when that communication is lost, then they're on their own. They're alone, and all parental guidance and influence and involvement is really a thing of the past. Second point that Rav Volbi makes, be a good role model, a personal example. Every child naturally wants to identify with his parents and imitate them. This role model is a very, very important thing. You know, we used to hear in the earlier generations, parents rebuking their children, saying, do as I say, not as I do. There is no such thing. They're not interested in what you have to say. They will identify and emulate what you actually do. And they're very, very alert. They pick up nuances. It does seem that the next generation is always a little bit smarter than their parents. Maybe it's because they came from smart parents, but they always seem to have an edge on us. And they pick up everything. And if it isn't genuine, if it isn't real, if it isn't sincere, if it isn't total and absolute, they pick up on it. So to be a role model, it has to be a real, in-depth, heartfelt, not just lip-serviced role model to set the example for our children. And it takes advantage of the fact that a child craves to imitate, to emulate, to identify with his parents. They're such an important part of his life, and they have such an influence on him that that's the natural craving to identify them. Little kids dress up like parents. They act like parents, and they're playing. They're role playing because they want to identify with their parents. And if the identity that they forge is something, or if the example that we provide is something less than the role model that we wish to present, our children are going to pick that up, and we're going to regret and have complaints to them about acting in the way that they really have seen by us. That means our language that we speak, that means the tone with which we speak, that means the respect with which we speak to one another, to father, to mothers, to spouse, to children, to outsiders, to strangers. This is all part of what they're going to pick up and what they're going to imitate. And when we set the role model of happiness and fulfillment, then that's what they're going to catch and internalize. When we set a role model of annoyance and burden and overwhelming discomfort, then they pick up that our lifestyle is discomforting, and that's certainly not something that they want to do. So the role model that we set is certainly critical. This is an interesting point. He says we must have the appropriate goals for them and include the soul in the educational process. There's a serious distinction between secular education and Torah education. The goal of secular education is knowledge, information. Pick up the information, understand the information, remember the information, repeat, give back the information. That's basically what the process is about. The goal of Torah education is that the neshama, the being, the personality, the heart, the soul, the essence, the mind, the thinking, the actions, the value system, the feelings, the emotions, the passions, the concerns, the sensitivities, all of these have to be impacted by a Torah education and affected. And we want to guide and mold and direct our children in the proper direction. And they must understand that they're different from an animal, that the human being has body, which is in many ways similar to the animal kingdom and has its cravings and its desires and its needs and its passions, but there's a soul, there's a neshama, there's a spirituality, there's a sense of meaning and purpose that they want in life, there's a sense of values, right from wrong, there are sensitivities, there are self-images, the way we look at ourselves and the way we think about other people. And these are things that they must realize, that the impact of their Torah education has to be not just on the bodily actions, but has to be on the changes for the positive, the sensitivities, the appropriateness of feeling and emotion that's developed in the soul. And that part of it has to be clearly understood, and that that's really what distinguishes us from all of the other beings in creation. And the goal of Torah is to elevate that neshama and to mold it, this individual, this personality, into the best possible human being that he can be. The Bali Musa used to say that the world is like a laboratory, and a person, the Rabbeinu Shalom, gives a person chemicals and raw materials to work with. And we're supposed to take these raw materials and form and develop the best neshama, the best person, the best total person, guf and neshama, that we can possibly do. And this has to be the goal of the educational process. I think it's kedai to mention over here that one of the sad victims of our society and maybe our religious success of the last two or three generations is this sense of a human being feeling responsible for himself. We've made such accomplishments that we have so many rules and people have to abide by the rules, and we have so many high expectations. We set the dress code and we set the grooming codes and we set so many rules and regulation and disciplinary actions both in school and at home, and it's something that's accepted in our religious world and standardized and expected of everyone. And there's a subtle message, although this is very important to have, but there's a subtle message that comes across to our children, is that I'm not really responsible for myself. I'm not the one who's in charge of making myself a better person. It's the rules and regulations. It's the school. It's the teacher. It's the Rebbe. It's the parents. It's the society. And that message is devastating, because ultimately, a child has to learn from early on in life that he or she is responsible for that human being that he becomes, that elevated human being that he or she becomes, that molded, sensitized, and refined and perfected personality that he or she has to become. He or she is responsible for that. It's not going to be done by anyone else. Nobody else can do it for us. It's our own responsibility. So this has to be in many ways in our conversations, in our examples, in our learnings, in life's examples that we share, that has to be, our children have to get that message that their goal is to perfect and to develop and to improve themselves, and only they can do that, and all of the outside rules and regulations can only help them, but ultimately they have to take that responsibility. Here's an interesting one. Assess their needs rather than use them to fulfill ours. Especially in a society where the expectations are so clearly delineated, and depending on where we live on the spectrum, this is what's expected. This is the type of behavior, this is the type of attitudes, this is the type of profession, this is the type of work, this is the type of leisure, this is the type of dress, this is everything. And what that often leads us to is that we have certain needs that we want fulfilled. We want to be accepted in societies. We want our children to bring us or help bring us that acceptance, or at least not interfere with that acceptance. We have our own expectations, and we have our goals for them, and we have our aspirations, and we have the dreams that they've been growing up with, and we've been growing them with since they were born. And sometimes we have to take a step back and think about, what do they need? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? What are their interests? Chazal say, "Ein adam loymed ela mashali b'chofetz." Ultimately, a person is not going to learn something unless it's what liboy chofetz, is what his heart desires. And we have to look at their needs and their desires rather than just see them as the fulfillment and the expression of those desires that we have. It's a big and difficult challenge for parents to be able to do that. It certainly is not a simple feat, but it's something that really is critical to give them that sense of space to develop into what they are best suited to be. Of course, included in this is the sense of individuality, that every child is different. Even though on a superficial level we want our children to fit into certain general classifications and categories, but the reality is there are larger and smaller areas of difference, and those must be addressed because everyone is unique, and they will only succeed and be happy if their uniqueness is in some way satisfied. And again, I guess a corollary of this is encourage them to fulfill their dreams instead of ours. So that goes on the way we look at them and the way we encourage them. And encouraging a child to be an individual, encouraging a child to have goals, to have desires, to plan, to think, and helping them to find the strength and the insight within themselves to figure out those things that are best suited for them. And this has to do not only with life goals, this has to do with learning styles, this has to do with extracurricular activities. This has to do, the more that we give a child the opportunity to dream and then to fulfill their own dreams, the more they are, they feel good about themselves, because I have a vision and I'm living up to it, and I'm even encouraged to live up to that vision, and it makes me feel like I'm somebody. I'm not just a victim. I'm not just a pawn. I'm not just being manipulated, but I'm dreaming, thinking, setting goals, and aspiring to live up to them. And that's a very fulfilling and a very validating and uplifting feeling. Another one he mentions here is avoid harshness, both physical and verbal. Harshness is insidious, for the distance it provides is not always immediately apparent. Very interesting, harshness. We would tend to think that that's not really a problem in our society, yet it does seem that inadvertently and unintentionally, there is a good measure of that, both physically and verbally. sadly enough, you know, sometimes if a person does something physical, you know, gives a person a slap or something, and there's a red mark or a scratch or something, some sign of this type of abuse, the sign maybe is not doesn't go unnoticed by others, but it also goes noticed by ourselves. Hey, what did I do? Look, the kid's red in the face. I hit this kid. I responded in such a terrible way. I should be ashamed of myself. Why did I do such a thing? Verbal abuse is oftentimes not even noticed. What did I say? You know, I wasn't screaming. Yes, you were. I didn't say anything insulting. Yes, you did. I didn't put the kid down. Absolutely, you did. It's very easy on the verbal level because sometimes so many of the parental tirades that come forth, we have no idea what we're saying. It just comes. It comes actually from love. It comes from caring. It comes from being hurt. But it comes with such a vengeance and a venom sometimes that it can devastate. And even the simplest, and we've mentioned this, even the softest, the most gentle type of rebuke can oftentimes be devastating. Certainly, certainly that which comes, you know, in a harsh way, and quite often we don't even realize it, and kids will tell horror stories of the things that they hear at home, the things that their parents say to them, and the parents will deny it, and not because they're lying, just because they're completely unaware. So we have to maybe, I don't know if we have to leave tape recorders around the house or communicate with a spouse or with other children to see, you know, how we're handling certain situations, but it's very important to realize and to avoid this kind of harshness and to realize that it's something that we oftentimes fall into it and we don't realize. And sometimes you see in therapy sessions and family therapy that the kid begins to unload a whole litany of memories that are just overwhelming, and the parent sits there and says, "Never happened. It can't be. It's not me. It's a different person. It's a different parent." And they can't believe some of the harsh and almost maybe cruel comments and making fun of and put downs and abusive talk that has come out unintentionally. So that's something that you have to be very, very careful about, because it's so easy to ignore, to misread, or to forget that this is a reality. And the last on his list is motivate and inspire. It's very important to motivate our children. Now, there are many things that motivate. Many people are motivated by reward, and that's a very legitimate motivation. That's, you know, giving a child candies or whatever other rewards are appropriate, and even on an adult level, that's mitoch shelo lishma bo lishma. They're really learning, and they want to learn, and they want to do what's proper, because they're going to get a reward, and that is a motivation. And on a younger level, that's probably the best motivation. As they get a little bit older, we can motivate maybe in more sophisticated ways. And of course, one of the most powerful motivations is the motivation of happiness. If we can inspire our children and make them aware that a life of Torah and mitzvahs and the study of Torah, the observance of mitzvahs, and the appropriate building of family that ensues from that, if they can realize that this is their best shot at true happiness in life, and this will in fact bring him that sense of fulfillment, that sense of happiness, that sense of, as we define all the time, happiness, sense of validation, feeling good about themselves. If they can realize that this is going to make them feel good about themselves, that will be the greatest inspiration to grow, the greatest inspiration to observe, the greatest inspiration to accomplish. It's not enough to lecture about that. We also have to model that. They have to see that a life of Torah and Mitzvahs has made us happy. They have to see what it means to face the vicissitudes of life with Bitochen and Hashem and to remain happy because everything's under control and I trust in him and everything's going to be okay and there's nothing to worry about and enoid muvadoi and so forth and so on. They have to see it. We have to model it. We have to feel it. If they see nervousness, if they see panic, if they see fear in difficult moments, then we're not inspiring them with this sense of that this is the way to feel good. They have to see a certain passion. Passion is very inspiring. They see not the passion with which we lecture them, the passion with which we ourselves observe the life and the lifestyles of Torah and Mitzvah. And when they feel passion, wow, this is beautiful. I want to do it. I crave to do it. It makes me feel good. I feel so good about myself after I did it. And this is a way of life that truly makes me feel good about myself. When they hear that, when they know that, and especially when they see that, it has a very powerful impact. And then they also have to have the opportunities to experience it themselves. And we have to orchestrate situations where they will feel that way and point out to them. For example, if a kid goes to an ice cream shop and has splurges on the most delicious ice creams that they want. And then later in that day, they go to a place where they can do chesed, to a nursing home, or to help old people, or to do something which is giving and which is meaningful. And then, you know, that was their day. And you point out, like, here we are at night, they're both finished. Which one gives you a better feeling? And the answer should be obvious to anyone, is that the ice cream is gone, done, and maybe sticks around in a couple of extra pounds, but that's it. And yet this chesed, I quell from the chesed. I feel so good about it. The ice cream doesn't usually come back in my mind as I'm falling asleep at night and I think about that ice cream. But the look on that lady's face when I helped her, when I made her feel good, the look on this gentleman's face when I sang to him a song and he felt like he was back in the Alta Heim. I mean, these are things that linger forever. And our children have to see that the happiness comes from doing the right things, from doing the proper things, and from giving. And when they get that inspiration and that motivation, then they're ready and willing to live a life of Torah. So the suggestion is and I'm going to suggest that if it isn't already, it may be, I think, on our website. But the suggestion is that it is, I think it may be, I think it is, so that these types of things that we should review constantly and elaborate on our mind, just like any Torah concept that we have to learn Musar about, and it's something that we know here, nothing radically new about any of this, but it's something that has to be here in the heart all the time. And that's, if we work on it, it'll certainly will succeed and will certainly have a major impact on the lives of our children.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.